So I'm reading out of 2 Timothy 4:6-8. I think it's up on the screen. It says, "For I am already being poured out like a drink offering, and the time has come for my departure. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. All right, Kevin, thank you so much. It is a joy and a privilege to be in front of you and to be bringing the Word of God to you this morning. Just a quick snapshot of who I am and where we've come. I grew up mostly in Houston, Texas. That is where I was hoping there'd be a whoo, but nothing out here from Houston, right? It's all good. I didn't really like Houston either. I grew up in Houston, Texas, 1988. Yeah. Wow, it was a good year for y'all, huh? 1988, my family moved to Greenville, South Carolina. It was culture shock, you know, just big town to small town, Texas to South Carolina. And I've been there ever since. I went off to school there, got married there, began ministering there, had my two children there, Tyus and Eli. And about 2 months ago, we moved to San Diego, California. And yeah, there you go. And so we've begun a new chapter in our lives. We're here. We're all here. We're thrilled to be here. But to be honest, the culture shock that came from you know, Texas to South Carolina is nothing like the culture shock I'm experiencing right now from South Carolina to San Diego, California. It is a different place, and we love it. We're thrilled to be here. I speak on behalf of my wife and our team to say that it's just been a real joy and a privilege to be here. There's a couple things, when we have more time, you'd like to explain to me about, you know, Southern California culture, if you would, right? Maybe the first thing is the June gloom. I have no idea what you're talking about. I grew up in Houston, Texas. If you've ever been in Houston in June, then you understand gloom, right? And the second thing is the marine layer. Can anyone explain the marine layer to me? Because I keep looking for Marines to jump out of some sort of a... See, baby, I told you that joke would work. And she said, don't do it. And I said, I'll try it. Who cares? The last thing, and this will be the last, and we'll get onto the text, but is the fireworks around here? Can y'all explain that to me? Because I lost my contact, and thankfully it was so bright in the air that I was able to reach down, find it, put it back in my eye, and the show was over. And I was a little disappointed, but maybe that's just living out here. And so we're here. We're all here, and if that's what it means to be here, we're ready for some shorter fireworks displays, and we're excited about it. All right, moving into a little bit of the context and the text that we find ourselves in this morning. Stephen has reminded us over and over, week after week, of what's happening here. Paul, the mentor, is speaking to Timothy, the mentee, right? And this letter is the last letter that he writes, and as Stephen has reminded us, Paul is on death row. He's about to face his execution. He's about to die. And the way that I envision this, is that he sees death right before him, right? He has no idea. He knows it's not years. He definitely knows it's probably not months, but he knows weeks and days before he dies and before he leaves this earth. And he's sitting there as death is right before him. He's sitting there and he's with a dear friend. It's not just a mentor-mentee relationship, because over and over in the scriptures, Paul calls Timothy his beloved son. It's a father-son love relationship that's going on there, right? And then he's reflecting back on his life, way back when Jesus just, you know, burst into the scene in Paul's life and radically changes him. And he starts walking forward with Jesus, and his life is forever changed. And everyone around him is being impacted by that. So I envision death right there, his dear friend right next to him, and reflecting back on his whole life. And we come to the apex of this letter. And this is really the end of it. This is really, after this, is just a couple concluding thoughts, a warning against an enemy, and then he's done. And this is the last we hear of Paul. This is the last writings of Paul in the scriptures. And so this is where we find ourselves. And as I thought about this, and I thought about where Paul was, I thought about this. Have you ever thought about your own death? Has the thought ever come to your mind, like, I wonder how I'm going to die? I wonder where I'm going to die? I wonder what is going to cause my death? Maybe it's cancer. Maybe it's a car accident. Who knows what it may be? Have you ever pondered those things? And some of you, I know, are realizing, I need to call Stephen and tell him never to leave again, right? That guy depressed me. Don't let the Indian back up. And I understand that. So, but have you ever thought a little bit about your funeral? Like, who's going to be there? What's going to be said about you? Your epitaph. Well, what's fascinating about Paul is he's just not pondering something in the far distant future. Death is right in front of him, right? Death is as near to him as it ever has been before. And in the midst of this, in his writings, we find some things that are very, very helpful to understanding all of life, right? When death is near, all of life becomes very clear. I want to say that over and over again. When death is near, life becomes clear. We begin to see what is significant, what is important, what is worth living for, right? What is worth dying for. When death is near, everything becomes very clear to us. Let me illustrate this for you in a personal story. A good friend of mine, what's funny is he reminds me a lot of Stephen. And a good-looking guy, played college football, very athletic, had a strong ministry, and had a beautiful wife, a child on the way. And at the age of 31, he found out he had colon cancer. And the doctor said to him, Rupert, you have what we believe about 30 to 50% chance of living within the next year, right? Shocking to him, right? His just eyes were just kind of blown away. And I remember calling him about a week after I heard the news, which he had just heard the news. And I called him and I said, buddy, how are you doing? And this is what he said to me. I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, Gijo, just a few days ago, before I heard about this cancer, just a few days ago, there were certain things that were like shouting in my life, right? Like my bills were shouting at my life, right? My little tiffs with my wife, like people and their approval of me was just loud and speaking very clearly. And that's all I could hear in the last few days. Because of cancer, those things have become a quiet whisper. They've become a quiet whisper. And I'm able to hear from my God for the first time in many, many months, he said to me. He said, I've heard as clearly from Jesus in the last few days as I've heard my entire life. And I thought about us this morning. I thought about us here, and I thought, what's shouting in your life right now? What's keeping you from hearing what Jesus wants to say to you? It's not that they're insignificant things. In fact, they're probably very important things. But what needs to be turned down by the power of God, by the grace of Jesus, just down to a whisper so you can hear from what Jesus has to say to you today, right? It might be your bills. It might be your relationships. It might be your work. Whatever it is, can we just ask Jesus, turn those down so we can hear from you. Jesus, I pray that you would give us that grace to simply do that. Just turn down the things so that we can hear from you. God, teach us about life. Teach us about death. Teach us about everything in between in these next few moments from Paul's life and from his last few words. So come and speak and teach. Pray this in the powerful name of Jesus. Amen. So when death is near, all of life becomes clear. When death is near, you know what else becomes very clear? Your treasure becomes very clear. We read in verse 6, for I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. When death is near, your treasure, your life, what you're spending your life on becomes very clear. The time of my departure, the second half of that is just simply saying what I said before, and that's he knew there was no miracle coming, and he wasn't going to escape this, but this was the end of his earthly time, and he was going to depart and go be with God. But the first half is really fascinating, isn't it? From already being poured out as a drink offering, I'm already being poured out as a drink offering. Well, let me illustrate to you this way. Paul says this about his life, right? He says, this is my life, right? And it's being poured out completely, down to the last drop, right? as a drink offering. Every bit of it. Not like instantaneously. He wasn't just, you know, suicidal here. But he says, every day my life is being poured out upon the church, right? In the Old Testament, there was this idea of sacrifices and offerings that were made. In fact, if you ever want to study about this, the whole book of Leviticus is about the offering system that was in place and that allowed people to enter into the presence of God. So there were sacrifices, these offerings, and there were animals that were sacrificed. And there were five main offerings, right? Sin offering was an animal that was sacrificed for the sins of the people. The guilt offering was a sacrifice. Peace offering, burnt offering, and I can't remember the fifth. Wave offering, yes, thank you, was being offered. Thank you very much. And the drink offering was this. The drink offering was a secondary offering that was that accompanied the main offering, right? It wasn't the main offering itself. It wasn't blood, but it was wine, actually, and it was the pouring out of wine as an offering. And that's exactly what Paul is saying his life is that his life is being just simply poured out as an offering, right? Because of the main offering, because of the guilt offering of Jesus on the cross, because of the peace offering that he provided, because of the sin offering, because of all the offerings that were provided, Paul says, I am being poured out as a drink offering upon the Lord. So we see this. And one thing that also really helps us understand this is a parallel passage where Paul is speaking at another time earlier in his ministry. This isn't the end of his ministry. He's not just simply speaking to one person, but he's speaking to an entire church or a congregation of people. And it's the church at Philippi. And this is what it says, and it'll come up here in a second. He says the bottom part, but even if I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and share my joy with you all. Even if I'm being poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, what exactly does that mean? This is what he's saying. He says, my life is being poured out, right, so that others would believe. My life is being spent, right, completely spent out, so that others would believe, and in turn, there'd be sacrifices and service that flow from their belief in God. That's how he was spending his life completely. And so I thought about it for us, and I thought, what is your life being spent on? All right? What's your time, your talents, your treasure? And how are those things really helping usher others to know God, right? And to walk with God and to commune with God and to know him specifically. When death is near, our treasure becomes more clear. Let me keep reading. I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. I have kept the faith. The idea here is that he's fighting, right? He's wrestling. He's struggling in this fight. And I love it. He says, not just any fight, but it's the good fight, right? And the good fight is the fight of faith. As we keep reading in that, I have kept the faith. The race is the race to believe, right? I have fought the good fight. And I love at the end, he says, I've finished. You know, when I first read this, it bothered me a little bit. I thought, Paul is so like, he's like a self-made Christian. That's what it appears like. I have done this, and I have done this, and look at all that I have done. Until I began to just take a step back from this one verse, I began to look at it in the context, and I realized, you know what he's doing here? He is trying to motivate young Timothy, who happens to be very timid. He happens to be very shy. He happens to have health issues. He happens to be weak-hearted. He happens to be one who struggles to believe. He hates, you know, persecution and hardships. And he's saying, listen, I've finished. I've made it. I'm at the end. I can do it. And because I've done it, you too can do it. Right? He was trying to motivate his young son in the faith, saying, listen, if God can get me through, he will get you through too as well. Timothy, I've made it, and so too can you. I love that picture right there. He's just feeding into his young mentee. I've finished the race. I've gotten to the end. I've made it, Timothy. I didn't turn my back on Jesus. I didn't forsake God. I was so tempted at times just to let it all go, right? And to say, but God has got me through. Verse 8. Therefore, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. When death is near, our treasures become very clear. When death is near, our motivations as well become very clear, don't they? When death is near, we realize, what has motivated my entire life? What has caused me to do all the things that I have done? In order to understand this passage, I think it'd be helpful for us to know, what exactly did Paul believe about death, right? What did he believe about dying? In fact, not just what does Paul believe about it, but what do Christians in general, what's the Christian view of death? I've just a few thoughts I want to run by you to just to kind of give us a little bit of context to understand this. Number one, death is inevitable, right? It will happen. It is going to happen, and Paul knew it was going to happen to him. It wasn't some far-out thought, but it was right there. He was right in the face of it. Number two, we weren't made for death, right? We weren't hardwired to experience death. When God created man, he did not create him for death, but he created us for life and for living, right? And so when death has entered, right, because we weren't hardwired for it, because we weren't made for it, it is hard, right? It is scary. It is devastating. It is hard to deal with, especially for those who remain, right? When we have friends or family members that have passed on, it seems often for me that they have more peace than I have had through the whole process, right? Death, we weren't made for this. It is foreign to, it's a foreign substance into life that life wasn't meant for. It is why we're terrified of it, whether we are, you know, man enough to admit that, in a sense. It is why it is difficult. It is a challenge. It is fearful for us that we weren't made for it, and therefore, it's a challenge. It's scary. So one, it's inevitable. Two, it is unbelievably difficult because we weren't made for it. And three, the cross of Christ takes away the power of death, right? When Jesus died and when he was risen from the dead, and now that he ascends and he lives on high, he has removed the power of death away. Not necessarily the temporary pain, because we still experience temporary pain, right? But the power of death has been removed from us. The sting of death, as Paul wrote to the Corinthian church, he says, death, where's your victory, right? Death used to be an end. It used to be like, you get death and that's it. And we Christians, those who are Christians in the room, we understand it is not the end, right? But he said, death, where's your sting? It has been removed from death. And therefore, when we trust in Jesus and his death on our behalf, then we know that death can't harm us anymore, right? We know that that's to be the case. Death used to be the end, and now it's something we simply pass through. Death used to be the end. It's something we pass through. Let me explain this to you. You know, the idea of death being an end, and even in the Bible times, the idea of a tomb was the end, right? When you were put into a tomb, it was like you were buried. It's it. It's like a coffin, right? We were put into a tomb. And Tim Keller says it this way, and I love. He says, when Jesus entered into death, entered into the tomb, he blew a hole through the other side of death, right? He has blown a hole through the other side of death so that we simply pass through death to the other side. Are y'all with me on that? That's a beautiful, beautiful picture for me, because death no longer has a sting. No, it's no longer the end. It no longer has victory. It's no longer the tomb, because on the other side is a hole that's blown through by the death and resurrection of Jesus that we walk through. And he takes us by the hand and he walks us through to the other side. I love that picture. It is so helpful for me to see. And not only does Paul say this, but Jesus said it over and over and over again. Let me just share one passage with you. Jesus said, Matthew 16:28, there's a slide for it. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. They will not taste death. Jesus will walk them right through, right? Then the power is gone, and they enter into the other side. So the cross has taken the power of death away and allows us to pass through death for those that are in Christ. And then finally, as we pass through, Paul recognized this, that there is more to life on the other side, right? There's more righteousness. There's more love. There's more joy. There's more peace. There's a perfect peace. There's perfect relationships. There is more on the other side. He says, therefore, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. Right? I found this fascinating. But I began to think about this, and I started realizing, you know, we all live for a day, don't we? We're all living for a day. Maybe it's retirement for you. Maybe it's the day that you get married, right? Maybe it's the day, there you go. Was that EJ or was that Danny? Both, because now they're one. So we all live for a day, don't we? Maybe it's a day that, you know, you have children. Maybe it's a day that your children go off to college. You know, it's like, I can't wait for that day. Or maybe it's a day that they've been back from college, but they leave again. And who knows? What is that day? Maybe it's your retirement day. We all live for a day. Paul had in view of that day that he would pass through, and he lived all of life in light of that day, right? He lived all of life in light of that day. Our motivations become very clear. We call this day in our house the happy day, right? We call it the happy day. And my boys, we talk about this day. We say there are no more tears, no more ouchies, right? No more death, no more fears. Those are all part of the happy day. And just to give you one story, our kids are beginning to understand this, and even one day they went as far as to say, there are no more dead bunnies. And in the happy day, and I said, yes, that's absolutely true. You got to understand the context a little bit of why they would say no more dead bunnies. First of all, you should probably know this about me, and I'm about to divide the room in half, just so you understand. But I'm a dog person, not a cat person, all right? So now some of you, I don't know what you're woohooing about, but some of you now hate me, and some of you love me more, right? I hope. I'm a dog person. About a year ago, we were at the Lowe's parking lot of all random places in Greenville, South Carolina. I had my two little boys with me. They were running around. I grabbed them, said, Amy, you pay for the stuff. We'll take them out. I walk up to my car, and I hear a kitten just kind of meowing. And I don't like cats. And I look around my tire on my car, I have the whole thing, and there's a little kitten, and he is starving. You could just see, you know, his bones just kind of all over him. And he's lost his tail. And so he's tiny, I know. And I began to experience something in my own heart. There was this hardening of my heart to this animal, right? I was like, ah. But at the same time, it was like, he does kind of look hungry. And I was like, I got to hurry up and get this cat out of here before my wife shows up. But it was too late. She shows up, and she's a rescuer. And she is... we have to get him, and we have to feed him, and we have to take him in. And long story short, that's exactly what happened. And there was food, there was a shoebox, and that's another story in and of itself. I trapped him, didn't hurt him, not that I know of. So he came and lived with us. We took care of him. We fed him. You know, we got him neutered. We just did all the stuff for him. And I found out something that I didn't know about this cat. This cat was a murderer. Right? And I'm not kidding. He would bring dead animals. He would just find these animals, he'd bring them to our doorstep, and he'd just sit there, right? Have y'all ever experienced this with cats? Evil animals. I don't really get them. My dog has never brought anything dead to my doorstep yet. So he'd just sit there. And I know cats can't smile, but I promise you, I think this cat was smiling at me every time. He's just this conniving little thing, this little pause. Anyway, I'm going to need to stay focused. And so this was kind of a traumatic experience, and we were trying to protect our children from it. One day, you can see where this is going. My kids see a bunny in the yard, right? And they come running up to it, and I realize, oh, I better run up to it too. And sure enough, the bunny looks funny. Yes, the bunny looks funny. I begin to look at it, and I realize something is on that bunny. And I realize what it was. It was his intestines that were on the outside, right? And my poor children felt what you just felt. Right? This horror. Like, it was like, bunny, bunny, bunny. You know, I was like, ah. And, like, it devastated my little four-year-old. It just devastated him, right? He was like, and so when we talk about the happy day, it is a real day. It is coming. For my little four-year-old, it's no more dead bunnies. And I don't know what it is for you, but there is a happy day that's coming. What day are you living for, right? And what part of redemption can you not wait for, right? What do you just long to see fixed that is so broken? I have this love-hate relationship for this road because I get broken over till 2, and I pray and I pray and I pray that God would shut that place down because I can't wait for the happy day where no more prostitution, no more sin, no more brokenness, no more broken homes, no more people-pleasing, no more fighting with friends and family members, right? Friends, whether you live like it or not, in the depths of who you are as a Christian, you long for that happy day, right? And you, together with Paul, we long for that day. We cannot wait. And yes, there's some glimpses of the better that is to come that's on this earth that we enjoy, but it does not compare to the happy day that Jesus is coming and that he's going to make all things right. He says it in Revelation 21 very, very clearly. I'm sorry, I lost my place. He will wipe every tear from your eye. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. There's no more sadness, no more sickness, no more hunger, no more divorce, no more Parkinson's disease, or no more murders or anything of that sort. Your motives become clear. So when death is near, our treasure becomes clear. When death is near, our motivations become clear. And then finally, when death is near, our victory is clear. Our victory is clear. I want to jump back to verse 7. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I've kept the faith. Let me speak for a second for those that are following Jesus in the room. And I know there are those that are not or just investigating Jesus and the claims of Christ. And I want to tell you how thankful I am that you're here and that you're able to listen in. But I'm going to have like a little bit of a conversation with those that have Jesus in them and that are walking with Jesus for a second. And as you listen in, if you're not that person, I hope that you would see that the Christian life is very real and it's hopeful and there is life to be had in it. But I don't know many of you, but I do know this about you. You struggle in your Christian faith, right? You wrestle in your journey, right? There is a constant fighting to believe, right, that God is better, that there's angst in your heart. There is, at times, if you're really, really honest, you've wanted to throw in the towel, right, to this whole Christianity thing, right? Like, I'm tired of sin. I'm tired of not wanting God more than I want other things, right? I'm tired of just really struggling in my Christian walk. I'm tired of being fearful of people that I want to tell Jesus about Jesus to. All of those things are going on. Let me tell you something else about you. Not only do you struggle, but when you struggle, you feel an enormous amount of guilt and shame, right? If you're real honest, if you're really just being true and open before God and before yourself, you begin to feel guilty, right, for your struggling. You begin to just to in a sense, beat yourself up. And you begin to think things like, God is just mad at me. He is not pleased with me. He is not happy with me, right? He is angry with me, right? And he is, yes, he loves me, and yes, he died for me, but he doesn't like me. There's no way he can like me because I don't even like myself. I mean, look, if I did what I do to God, I mean, I wouldn't like that person either, right? Over and over, we tell ourselves lies. Over and over, guilt is a struggle for the Christian. And what Paul tells me in this passage, and he tells us, is that the normal Christian life involves struggling, right? And this is great news. That is a lie from the pit of hell, right? When you believe that God is displeased with you, that he's angry with you, that he's mad, that he hates you, that he can't stand you. Those are all lies from the pit of hell. Those are not true about you and me if you're a child of God's, right? It is absolutely not true. And that, in fact, he is the rescuer. He wants to come in and save us. He wants to come and help us with our temptations. He wants to help empower us to walk the Christian life. He is all of those things to me. He is not mad. He's not angry at your struggle. He wants to rescue you. And oftentimes, my feelings and your feelings trump what is true, right? They just seem to be more true at some point. And it is a fight. It is a constant fight to struggle. And I think to myself, you know, if I was a good Christian, I'd be like Stephen and I wouldn't have any struggles. And by the way, that's not true, right? Man, that would be it. That would be what it meant to be a strong Christian. And Paul says, no, no, no. What it means to walk the Christian life, the normal Christian life, I'm at the end of it. And Timothy, I want you to know something. I fought throughout all of that. It's not like I have victory over victory over victory. It's like I just fought, right? And I think one of the reasons we want to throw in the towel is because we forget who God is and what he thinks about us, right? We often forget this. Let me share one verse and one story and I'll be done. 1 Corinthians 10. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. If you're a child of God right now, you know, God allows every little temptation to sift through his hands to come upon you, right? That he knows he's allowed those things to come into your life, right? And yet, this is what it's about to say, also what comes through his hand is just an ocean of rescue, right? It's like an ocean of rescue that he says this, God is faithful. He will never let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with temptation, he will also provide a way of escape so that you'll be able to endure it. There's never a time you're tempted where there isn't a rescuer right alongside you. And oftentimes, the way he does this is through other believers, right? It's through living in community. It's living in open fellowship with one another. Oftentimes, that's the main way as we live together in community, as you're part of community groups and discipleship groups and all. That is a way in which God just rescues us. Just like my wife rescued that that animal because of her love, not mine, through me, so too does God rescue us through each other. And the fight here, friends, the victory in the Christian life is to fight. Victory is to fight, right? Let me share one story. So it was about 4 years ago, Tyus was five. So we have a five-year-old and a three-year-old, basically. Tyus is five. He's our Italian, and he looks Italian. And Eli is our Indian, or he looks somewhat Hispanic, so it's kind of like, what is he? And I have multiple people say, whose child is that? And I'm like, who else walks around with people that aren't, you know, like, who else? It's my child. Leave me alone. And I'm one of those struggling Christians right now. Leave me alone. Don't want to talk to you. He's a 1 year old at this time, or about 10 months. And he's at that stage of development where he's crawling really well, and he's strong enough to pull himself up. And everywhere he crawls and pulls himself up, he looks to me, right? And he says, Dad, aren't you proud of me? You know, have y'all ever seen that in a child? It's a beautiful picture. I love, love, love seeing the children in that stage of development. So that's going on. The second thing you need to know is he is enamored with television. I think we all are. Whenever TV's on, it's like this little children just kind of turn their head and they just see TV, right? Every time. I do that as a big child, and you do that. And then the third thing is I do a little woodworking on the side. Now, this is part of the story. And if you come into my house, there's a black armoire, and it's right there, and I built it. And if you come to the house, whatever you do, don't lean on it. And in fact, don't even stand near it, right? Like, just leave it alone. And it's not you. It's my contraption, my little creation. And at the same time, I also had this huge TV. Now, some of you, if you're under 20 in the room, you don't understand what I'm about to tell you. But there, back in the day, they used to have these TVs that weren't flat screens, right? They're really big and heavy. And they'll break your back. Like, they have these tubes in them, and they're extremely heavy. I don't know what kind of metal they put in those things, but it's got to be the heaviest metal in the earth because these TVs are heavy. So there's my son. There's my armoire and a heavy TV. You see where this is going. There was one place where my son wasn't allowed to climb up to and crawl up to, and that was that. And I'd say, buddy, no, no. Come over here. And we would play this game. I'd sit on my chair, and he'd be in the middle of the room, and he would look at me, and then he'd look at that TV, right? He'd look over at me, and then he'd look at that TV, and I'd be like, buddy, no, no. I know what's going on in your head, right? And he would turn, get on all fours, and just start running, right? Pull himself up and look at me. And I'd be like, no. And I had to go pick him up and say, buddy, no, you can't do that. You got to come back over here. And then you'd cry and you'd be upset. And then one day out of the blue, he looked at me, he looked at the TV, and he decided, I'm going to crawl over to Daddy. And you know what happened in my heart? I jumped out of my seat. And I picked him up, and I threw him in the air, because that's what we did when we celebrate. It's not a bad thing. And I hugged him, and I kissed him. Yeah, it wasn't like abuse here. It was just, he loved it. And I threw him in the air, and I said, buddy, I'm so proud of you. I love you. I'm so proud of you. And he was like, wow, this is awesome, right? And so he would come to me often, right, and away from the TV. And I began to see this as not my son on the ground, but me. Right? And I know what I think about him. And I wasn't mad at him for running to the TV. I was sad for him, but I wasn't mad at him. I wasn't angry with him, right? I wasn't like, what are you doing, son? I was like, come away. That is gonna harm you. Come be with me, right? And we would celebrate. That's what we do in our house. That's what Jesus does with us. We celebrate when he would come in obedience to me. One day, I had an even greater breakthrough. And this day, he sat in the middle of the floor, Tyus did. He looked at me. He looked at the TV. He looked at me, looked at the TV again. And instead of running to the TV and instead of running to me, he just sat there and just struggled. Like I saw it in a little 10-month-old face. Like it was so difficult for him, right? He so wanted to go to Daddy. He so wanted to go to what was temptation for him. And you know what I did? I jumped out of my seat, and I went and grabbed him, and I said, buddy, it's okay. I'm not mad at you for struggling, right? God is not mad at us when we struggle to believe he's better, right? He wants to rescue us. He wants to run into our lives through many other people, and he wants to pick us up, and he wants to hold us. He says, I'm not mad. I love you. I cherish you. You are the apple of my eye. Come back to me. Come to me. This is the safest place you can be. That to me was a breakthrough, that God is not mad at me when I struggle. And he helps me, right? He's a rescuer for me. When death is near, all of life becomes very clear. When death is near, our treasure becomes clear. When death is near, our motivations become clear. And when death is near, victory becomes clear. And victory is struggling with him. Are you with me? Band, why don't you come on up? And this is this song we're about to sing is a great song in response. This is a great way to respond. Can we get the first line of the song to come on up? Let no one caught in sin remain inside the lie of inward shame, but fix our eyes upon the cross and run to him who showed great love. Next slide. And he bled for us. Freely you bled for us. Christ is risen from the dead, trampling over death by death. Come awake, come awake, come and rise up from the grave. Because Jesus is arisen, we too are alive with him. And he has empowered us with the resurrected Jesus to crawl back up to the Father. And when we struggle, allow him to come in and rescue us. Let's sing to that end. Mm-hmm.